Half Price Horror.
Hello and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at Alien from 1979, directed by Ridley Scott, from a screenplay by Dan O'Bannon with additional story material by Ronald Shusett, Walter Hill, and David Giler. The concept began with O'Bannon, though, who had come off of his collaboration with John Carpenter on the 1974 sci-fi comedy Dark Star, with a reputation as a talented production designer. Dark Star was made with a budget of only $60,000, but looked as though it was significantly more expensive. This deeply embittered O'Bannon, whose main interest was in directing, but he nonetheless joined the team working on Alejandro Jodorowsky's production of Dune. The Dune production collapsed in 1976, leaving O'Bannon broke and forcing him to crash with his friend Ron Shusett for an extended period. But it also left him with a network of friends who would become legends in the industry, like Jean Giraud, aka Mobius, and H.R. Giger. O'Bannon took on production work to pay the bills. In particular, it's his computer animation that demonstrates the chain reaction that will destroy the Death Star in the original Star Wars. Well, he and Shusett worked on an idea he had for a movie called Star Beast, based on his struggles with Crohn's disease and articles he'd read about a predatory wasp that lays its eggs inside the abdomen of a paralyzed spider. I mentioned Star Wars in particular for a couple of reasons. First, O'Bannon and later Ridley Scott were both heavily influenced by Lucas's documentarian style and emphasis on working-class naturalism, along with the documentarian style of Kubrick in 2001 A Space Odyssey. I know I mention these two films a lot, but talking genre film without talking about 2001 and Star Wars is like discussing mammalian evolution without bringing up the Chicxulub impact. And second, in the wake of the absolutely gargantuan box office returns of Star Wars, everybody but everybody was trying to replicate its success, and really would be for the rest of film history to the present day. Getting an FX heavy sci-fi picture out there was a must for every major studio in 1979. The studio saw potential in Star Beast, which had already been retitled by then as Alien, based on the number of times it was used in the screenplay, but they brought in rewrite expert David Giler and Hollywood legend Walter Hill to polish the script and add extra tension. Ridley Scott was brought in to direct on the strength of his feature debut, The Duelists, while the special effects and production design were overseen by a team of absolute legends that included Giger, Mobius, Carlo Rambaldi, who is best known for E.T., and an uncredited Anton First, who is best known for the 1989 Batman. Basically, throw a rock on this set and you'd probably hit someone who would go on to do behind-the-scenes work on a classic genre movie. Which very nearly happened. O'Bannon had hoped to direct the film, and finding out that not only had someone else gotten the job he wanted, but that his screenplay was being rewritten and he was being crowded out of the major production design decisions, left him virtually apoplectic with rage. All the way up to his death, he never got over this. He never got over anything, to be honest. His outbursts alienated, no pun intended, the producers, his co-writers, the director, and virtually everyone apart from Shusett who could help him springboard off of Alien's success to another movie. Which wasn't to say this was his last genre hit, but it was an example of the way that Dan O'Bannon tended to be his own worst enemy when it came to Hollywood. The film stars Sigourney Weaver as Ripley. She was not given the first name Ellen until the sequel. Weaver, daughter of television producer Sylvester Weaver Jr., beat out a young Meryl Streep for the role, and even though she was drastically underpaid compared to the male actors, she only earned $35,000 for the part, it paid off with the kind of fame that made her an A-list actor in movies like Ghostbusters, Working Girl, Gorillas in the Mist, Galaxy Quest, and Avatar, as well as reprising her role in the next three sequels to this film. If you ever wonder why she kept coming back for the Alien sequels, even as the scripts maybe didn't live up to her expectations, it's because she kind of felt like she could get some money out of them, and she deserved it after getting underpaid so badly for this film. Joining her as the command crew of the Nostromo, the ship's name is taken from the title of a Joseph Conrad novel, is Tom Skerritt as Dallas. Skerritt was famous even at the time, but he's gone on to do parts in films like The Dead Zone and Contact, among over 100 others, and John Hurt as Kane. Kane was an equally lauded character actor who'd been seen on British television for decades when this film was released, and who went on to win an Oscar for his role as John Merrick in David Lynch's The Elephant Man, along with dozens of other amazing roles. He was in 1984 in 1984. He was the voice of the Horned King in The Black Cauldron, and yes, he was the missing incarnation of the Doctor in the 50th anniversary special of the series, before his passing in 2017. Rounding out the Nostromo's crew, we have Veronica Cartwright as Lambert. Cartwright is yet another hardworking character actor, probably best known apart from this for her role in the 1979 remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. She and Weaver were originally hoping to get each other's parts in this film, but after rewrites, Scott decided they fit better as filmed. Harry Dean Stanton as Brett, a character actor's character actor, with over 200 roles, including films like Escape from New York, Repo Man, Christine, Red Dawn, Pretty in Pink, The Last Temptation of Christ, and Marvel's Avengers before his death in 2017. Ian Holm as Ash. Again, another legendary character actor who was in films like Time Bandits, Brazil, and Naked Lunch prior to his death in 2020, but who's probably best known as Bilbo Baggins in Peter Jackson's adaptations of the Lord of the Rings novels, and Yaphet Kotto as Parker. Kotto is, you guessed it, a legendary character actor, with roles like Mr. Big in Live and Let Die, William Laughlin in The Running Man, Alonzo Mosley in Midnight Run, and Doc in Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare prior to his passing in 2021. The last few years have not been great to the stars of this movie, as you may have noticed from those dates. The voice of the ship's computer, Mother, was played by Helen Horton, who didn't have any real signature roles, but who remained a working actor until her death in 2007, and the alien itself was performed by Balahi Badejo, who didn't really pursue acting and who passed in 1992. He was assisted in certain scenes with stunts by an uncredited Eddie Powell, who also did stunts in Aliens, Enemy Mine, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and Willow, among others, prior to his death in 2000. The film opens with a shot of a planet as seen from outer space, with a series of strange hieroglyphics appearing at the top of the screen. A vertical slash in the center, then two slashes at either end angling inwards, each line coming closer and closer to finally revealing the title, Alien. This was designed by an uncredited Saul Bass, who had a long-running career designing titles for films from West Side Story to Spartacus to Psycho to North by Northwest to Big to It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. The camera slowly pans from the planet to the ship Nostromo, which, as a caption informs us, is a commercial towing vessel with a crew of seven, currently towing an entire refinery with 20 million tons of mineral ore on board, back to Earth. Certainly there have been a lot of people over the years who speculated about the mineral wealth of space. The asteroid belt around Earth probably contains trillions of dollars worth of ore, although, of course, bringing it all back would crash the market in much the same way that Alcoa turned aluminum from a metal more precious than gold into something we make our pop cans out of. Certainly the ship and the refinery it tows are massive. In the wake of Star Wars, it became almost de rigueur to show a vast spaceship flying over the camera a la the Star Destroyer. You can also see this in Tron, and it's actively parodied in Spaceballs. Once it passes overhead, we cut to the interior of the ship, which is a series of deserted industrial corridors that call to mind the Millennium Falcon. Not to harp on all the Star Wars comparisons, but they're genuinely relevant here. Among the many ways that Star Wars was groundbreaking was by portraying space as an environment that people genuinely lived and worked in, not just the domain of square-jawed military types and bug-eyed monsters. When Luke says about the Millennium Falcon, "What a piece of junk!" he's establishing that a science fiction universe can be as mundane for the characters who inhabit it as it is stunning and revelatory for us, and O'Bannon really got that idea. He took it and ran with it by giving us a gigantic starship where everyone has their own personal coffee mug hanging in the galley. After a long, slow pan that almost serves as a tour of the ship, we arrive on the bridge, where the dormant computers spring to life with information about the Nostromo's current location and status. Something is waking up this silent, empty vessel, and down in a sterile white room, the lights slowly flicker to life, followed by the cryonically frozen crew. There's something almost parodic about the way that these seven characters emerge like newborns from their sleek, stylized creches, wearing what honestly do look a little like diapers. It's as though we're seeing a future where sex has been replaced by the emotionless gestation within a loveless machine, and everyone wakes up bored, sexless adults. David Scull's book The Monster Show has an excellent Freudian analysis of this film that almost makes up for the weird anti-birth control screed he inserts into his discussion of Rosemary's Baby. But, you know, he does point out there's a lot of dialogue and a lot of scenes about sex that were cut from this movie. Originally, these characters had casual sexual relationships with one another, not even out of an emotional connection so much as to pass the time. And all of that material was cut. Everything about sex is cut from the movie. The only reference or mention to sex is the alien itself, the facehugger, and its impregnation of Kane. Spoilers, sorry. But it's important to understand that with no other reference to sex, the idea of sex becomes horror in this movie. It's talked about a lot in slasher movies, you know, Jason and his ilk punishing people for having sex, but here, sex is scary in a way that it is not in any other slasher. And yes, even though this is an alien movie, even though this is a science fiction movie, at heart it's a slasher movie. But it's clear when the characters wake up and begin to have breakfast that there's nothing newborn about these people. They have the desultory banter and tired rote bickering of a group of co-workers who've known each other too long and are thoroughly sick of each other's company in a low-key, grinding way. They're sick of the reconstituted food, they're sick of having the same arguments over bonuses and contracts, they're sick of people treating them like they have the authority to negotiate bonuses and contracts when they're basically just middle management. They've all been on a very long haul together and they can't wait to get back to Earth and see some new faces. But Dallas, the nominal captain, although it's clear that he ranks very low in the hierarchy of the company, gets a message from Mother, the ship's computer, which is for his eyes only. He goes back to the computer room, which looks very much like the interior of a mechanical womb with an angular curve to the walls and soft, warm lighting everywhere, and pulls up the new orders. They've been pulled out of their journey 10 months early and diverted to check out a signal from a planet near Zeta Reticuli. The crew doesn't know about the signal yet, but they soon figure it out when they find themselves nowhere near the Earth they've been craving to see. It's astonishing, by the way, how much world-building is in these scenes. When attempting to reach traffic control, the Nostromo declares its registry as out of the Solomons, presumably referring to the chain of islands in Oceania. Now, the company is never named verbally in the film, but you can see the Weyland-Yutani logo on the ship in certain scenes, as well as a red and white checkerboard pattern on the doors, which was apparently an inside joke among the production team regarding the Purina logo and the crew's status as Monster Chow. So this is a multinational corporation that uses a flag of convenience to avoid strict safety and labor standards, something which will come heavily into play in the third act. Speaking of safety, it's telling as well how little anyone worries about it in this film. You can basically break down all space movies into two categories, the ones where the problems of space travel are treated as solved, and the ones where they are still treated as problems. Or, if you will, the ones where space is trying to kill you and the ones where it isn't. Despite the gripes about bad food and janky technology and constant repairs, nobody ever worries about running out of supplies or losing oxygen or succumbing to any number of potentially catastrophic technical problems. And even the hypersleep appears to be more for convenience than anything else. Nobody is wondering what the world will be like when they get home, and they appear to have faster-than-light travel. Despite being almost 40 light-years from Earth, they only have a 10-month return journey. Another bit of world-building comes up when Dallas breaks the news to the crew that they need to investigate the mysterious repeating signal from the unnamed planet. It's funny, but so many of the elements of this movie are only given names in the sequels. Ripley asks if the signal is human in origin, and Dallas just gives a vague shrug of an answer, and nobody is shocked or surprised or even particularly interested in the idea of extraterrestrial life. It's not treated as something new or exciting, which tells you either something about the status of humanity regarding first contact or about the utter levels of don't-give-a-fuck chill that this group has after all this time out in space. There's a bit of bickering regarding the decision to investigate, with Parker and Brett complaining about their pay. Apparently, much of the specific dialogue was improvised based on backstories provided by Scott, who also encouraged a certain degree of tension between the actors as well, in the hopes of capturing realistic conflict. That's one of those things I really hate, to be honest. It always seems like it's an excuse for actors and directors to go on a power trip at the expense of the hard-working professionals that aren't being employed on the film, and it always comes up in the context of doing something unpleasant to them, quote-unquote, for realism. Nobody ever says, oh, my character is supposed to be incredibly nice, so I went around baking cookies for the cast to get into the role. In any event, Ash tells Parker and Brett that if they don't investigate, the contract says they forfeit their pay for the entire trip, and after that, they're right on board. One of the real triumphs of this movie is the way that it takes a lot of time to develop the characters and their stories before getting involved in the alien murders everybody plot. Like Friday the 13th, the deaths come in a rapid burst in the back half of the movie, giving you a chance to really appreciate Brett and Parker's working class frustrations and Ripley's annoyance with the sexism of Ash and the other men. You can see it especially well in this sequence, where Yaphet Kotto gives Parker a certain amoral charm even as he squabbles over everything from his bonuses to who's sitting in his chair. We could point out that the only black character in the film is portrayed exclusively as working class and primarily concerned with money. It is a fair criticism, even though the casting was supposedly colorblind. The Nostromo moves into orbit around the planet and detaches from its cargo before landing on a world that is very clearly uninhabitable. They have some trouble touching down, but again, this isn't a movie where space is trying to kill you. The damage to the engines is presented as an inconvenience that will delay their departure, not a potentially life-threatening emergency on a planet with a thin atmosphere of nitrogen and methane, and a temperature that's too low to sustain life. Brett and Parker are dispatched to do repairs. They exaggerate their time estimates, another sure sign that nobody's especially worried about this. They're like, oh yeah, it'll take 17, 25 hours. They're not concerned about getting off the rock in a hurry. Well, Kane, Lambert, and Dallas go out to investigate the signal. Ripley and Ash stay on the bridge to monitor their condition. Ripley does try to check on Brett and Parker's work, but they drive her off with unrelenting sexism and hostility. It is simultaneously a class-based scene and very much a scene about misogyny. Interestingly, though, this was a movie that was famously written gender-blind, so a lot of these tensions came out during filming. I've often wanted to see a stage production of this, something... There is a stage script for this movie, as it happens, and I'd love to see it with different races and genders playing the role from performance to performance, just to see whether or not different tensions would come out based on who was playing the role and who was acting in response to those characters. There's a lot of silence during these sequences, long stretches where the soundtrack is nothing but ambient noise and Jerry Goldsmith's stark minimalist score. It's a bold decision, relying on the visuals to carry the plot. Again, this harkens back to Kubrick in 2001, and it might not have worked if they'd had a less talented production team. But when you've got an all-star group like this, the visuals are striking and distinctive and frankly unprecedented enough to carry the show through the quiet moments. As the sun rises over the alien world, Dallas and his team head out to the source of the signal and find a massive horseshoe-shaped alien spaceship that appears to have crashed a long time ago. They send back images through a camera in their helmets and decide to go in for a closer look. Ripley, meanwhile, asks if Ash has ever tried translating the alien signal. See why it's called alien now? And oddly enough, the ship's science officer says no, he never really gave it a try. She begins working on it while the others look for a way in. And by the time she finds out that it's actually a warning and not an SOS, they've lost contact with the exploration team. Kane, Lambert, and Dallas enter the ship to find a disturbingly organic-looking interior with knobbly protrusions that look like the ends of bone and a glistening fleshy texture to the hallways. It looks like something that was grown or perhaps secreted. They reach what appears to be the bridge, which is dominated by the corpse of an absolutely gigantic alien life form sitting in a command chair. This was a 26-foot-high prop filmed next to children in spacesuits to make it look even larger. The chair seems to have grown into it, or it grew into the chair, and it has what we can safely say in hindsight is an extremely ominous chest wound where something burst out of it from the inside. Lambert is all for leaving at that point, but Kane finds a hole leading down into a cargo bay. They lower him down into it. This is another scene where Geiger's iconic production design really stands out. It looks like nothing so much as a descent into a giant esophagus. And he finds a layer of strangely illuminated mist, actually lit by some laser lights the Who was testing out for their live shows on the soundstage next door, with what can only be described as 2-foot-high eggs incubating in the warmth below. He goes to investigate one. As I've mentioned with Night of the Living Dead and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, this only seems like an obviously terrible decision to us because we've all seen Alien. This is a movie that irreversibly changes the pop culture landscape by its very existence, and sees motion within the translucent egg. The forelobe top peels open, and Kane looks inside. Okay, maybe this is pretty obviously stupid, even without the benefit of hindsight, and even with his spacesuit to protect him. And a creature lunges out and grapples his face. There's a horrible sizzling sound, and we cut away to the outside of the ship. The action then jumps forward to the team's return, with Lambert and Dallas carrying a limp and helpless Kane. They get into the airlock, but Ripley refuses to let them in once she finds out that whatever Kane found is attached and can't be removed from his body. She wants to follow quarantine procedures and keep them in the airlock for 24 hours. A tense exchange follows, with Dallas ordering her to let them in so that they can save Kane's life, and Ripley not unfairly pointing out that letting the creature into the ship could wind up killing all of them. But Ash manually overrides the inner door hatch and lets them in, rendering the question moot. In the infirmary, they cut Kane's spacesuit off to reveal a creature wrapped around his face. It has a shape roughly similar to a horseshoe crab, but with a more gelatinous, mollusk-like texture, and 8 long, slender arms that look almost like thin fingers. The tail is prehensile and reacts to being seen by wrapping itself more tightly around Kane's throat. And it has a bulbous protrusion on each side that looks disturbingly fleshy. This is what's come to be known to fans as the facehugger, one of the cornerstones of Alien lore. It's an absolutely brilliant piece of design and construction, originally set to be painted green until O'Bannon saw the flesh-toned latex and thought it looked much more horrible like that. Look, I may run the guy down for his lack of professionalism sometimes, but he's undeniably a genius. Dallas orders Ash to pry it loose, but the thing's fingers are literally embedded into Kane's scalp and can't be easily removed. They run some scans on what appears to be an MRI machine and discover that the creature has inserted some sort of proboscis down Kane's throat. Yes, I know. Spoilers, it's actually an ovipositor. Ash hypothesizes that it's feeding him oxygen, but Dallas doesn't care. He wants it removed immediately and he accepts full responsibility for the decision. When Ash cuts into it, though, an acidic yellow liquid splashes out onto the floor, eating its way entirely through 2 decks and well into a 3rd before attenuating. Obviously, even in a movie where space isn't trying to kill you, burning holes in your own spaceship is a bad plan. They can't risk cutting into it again. Now, I could, if I wanted, point out that acid for blood is as much a weakness as it is a strength. A sufficiently strong alkaline injected into the creature's veins could neutralize the acid, causing a reaction that would potentially shred its circulatory system in the process and kill it instantly. But I don't consider that a plot hole, because that's the kind of solution that the science officer would come up with. And spoilers, but Ash isn't feeling particularly motivated to find creative ways to bump this particular alien off. Speaking of, while Brett and Parker continue their repairs to the ship, Ash studies the images retrieved from the medical scans. It's been the subject of some fan speculation whether Ash actually knows what's happening with Kane at this point, but given the way he rapidly turns off the screen when Ripley walks in and makes weak excuses about still collating his data, I think we can safely assume that he has a pretty good idea. He's also shifty when Ripley confronts him on his decision to let Kane back into the ship, first trotting out the excuse that he was only following orders, and then pretending that it was a humanitarian decision made to save Kane's life by getting him to medbay. Ripley doesn't buy either one, but she doesn't exactly have any leverage she can use to get him to tell the truth. She leaves frustrated. It's worth noting that we do see Ash drinking here. Presumably he's capable of ingesting food and drink to maintain the deception that he's human. Spoilers. Sometime later, Ash calls Dallas down to the infirmary along with Ripley. It appears that the creature has disappeared. With an understandable degree of trepidation, they go looking for it, and there's a very effective jump scare when it falls out of a hatch in the ceiling onto Ripley's shoulder, but it's already dead apart from a few reflex twitches. Whatever purpose it wanted to serve with Kane, it's done, and like many single-purpose lifeforms, it didn't last long after that. Ripley wants to get rid of it on general principles, but Ash refuses to relinquish the specimen and Dallas caves in. He's of the opinion that there are a few too many coincidences involved in a brand new science officer being assigned to him on the trip where they just happen to run into a brand new alien life form, and he suspects that the company has a desired outcome to this journey, and he's not about to make waves. He orders Ripley to ignore the remaining repairs and get them back into space as quickly as possible. After a tense liftoff, they get back up to the refinery and redock. To further the good news, Kane has recovered from his coma with no apparent ill effects apart from a vague memory of being smothered and an intense appetite. The crew decides to have one last meal before re-entering hypersleep, which Dallas offers to pay for, raising some really interesting questions about the economy of the future. Parker and the others don't seem to react like this is a joke, so are they really charged by the company for their meals? Do they have to pay for other expenses, like medical exams in the hypersleep chambers? How much does this cut into their profits? Is this a company store situation where the pay they earn doesn't always cover their expenses on the trip, leaving them trapped in a cycle of debt? It's the kind of little touch in this just one line of dialogue that really makes this feel like a blue-collar, working-class future in a way that very few movies up to this point ever did, and I love that you can constantly investigate the dialogue for these little grace notes that hint at greater details. It's wonderful, wonderful world-building. But I'm digressing from the big moment. The scene that seared Alien into the memory of a generation and made it an absolutely iconic movie for decades to come. In the middle of joking banter about the quality of the reconstituted food, Kane suddenly begins choking and gagging, then goes rapidly into convulsions. The others lay him down on the table, trying to restrain him, but then suddenly a splatter of blood stains his white shirt. It's followed by another, this one a more violent gush that splatters all over Lambert's face, and finally by the emergence of an eyeless creature the size of a large rat with sharp metallic teeth and a long tail like the facehugger from before. And the purpose of the earlier alien becomes clear. It wasn't just feeding Kane oxygen through that tube. It was impregnating. It's a visceral, shocking moment, carrying with it the horrifying implications of sexual violence, and it was entirely intentional on O'Bannon's part. He wanted the men in the audience who watched it to feel violated on a very personal level at the thought of being forced to carry the offspring of a rapist to term, and to experience the disquieting possibility of further violence being done to the body by the act of childbirth. And it shot with a documentarian brutality that was inspired by the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which Scott watched during the production at O'Bannon's insistence, that looks even more raw and disturbingly biological compared to the sterile hypersleeps, crushes, and the mechanical womb of the computer room. This is an environment that's forgotten nature, and now nature is here to remind it how red in tooth and claw it can truly be. It's also worth mentioning that it's one of the few actual bursts of real violence in the movie. Like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, there's not much gore to Alien, but what there is presented with absolute ferocity, and it sears itself into the memory even more by the contrast with comparatively bloodless events around it, and it gives this movie a reputation for shocking gore and horror that, really, there's much more gory films out there, but there's none where the gore is presented with a much emotional weight. The creature lets out a screech as it emerges, then darts away into the shadows on its hind legs. With little else they can do for Kane, the crew ejects him into space in a ceremony that feels more functional than emotional. Then again, if one of your coworkers was suddenly eviscerated on the job and the boss told you that you had to bury him, how would you take it? These people aren't friends, they're not family. They're just stuck together, doing a job so boring that they sleep for most of it. So much of the terror comes from the cosmic unfairness of being exactly the wrong people to handle something like this. Speaking of, Brett manages to rig up an improvised cattle prod using some batteries, as well as a device that detects changes in density of airflow to locate moving objects. They split up into two groups to go looking for the alien, with Ash, Dallas, and Lambert in one group, and Ripley, Parker, and Brett in the other. I do find it kind of interesting that Dallas always picks Lambert to be on his team. There were supposed to be an emotional relationship between them, or at least a sexual one, and I kind of feel like you can detect some hints of that in the way that he always keeps her close. The plan is to herd it with the cattle prods and catch it in the net, which feels almost absurd to people who've seen the sequels or even the whole first movie before, but again, it's worth keeping in mind that these people haven't. They think they're looking for something along the lines of an angry raccoon. A pest, possibly even something that could do you an injury, but not a real and serious threat unless it's already inside your stomach. After a tense search, Ripley, Parker, and Brett detect something moving in one of the storage lockers. They open it up, only to find the ship's cat Jones, a lovely marmalade tabby, hissing at them in annoyance. Brett lets it run away, but Parker realizes that if they don't catch it, they'll only keep getting false positives on the sensors. He sends Brett off to fix his mistake while he and Ripley keep looking for the alien. Brett goes hunting for the cat, eventually catching up to it in a storage bay, but it runs away, leaving Brett to discover what appears to be the creature's shed skin before he continues his search. Incidentally, many of these scenes are much quicker to describe than to experience. From this point on, the film becomes an almost excruciating experience in rising tension followed by shocking bursts of intense violence. Brett enters another bay, this one full of dangling cargo chains and a constant shower of condensation from the coolant tubes overhead, which I suspect is probably not supposed to be happening, but we've already established that this is a ship that's probably been running past its safety parameters for a while now. He finds the cat again, but it retreats, hissing, as behind him the alien lowers itself from the chains to the floor and rears up to its full 8-foot-plus height. It's clearly experienced rapid growth in its brief life. The novelization claims that it broke into the ship's stores, engorged itself to build its muscle mass quickly, and it opens its mouth to reveal a second, smaller mouth inside that lunges out like a piston to tear into Brett's chest. Grabbing him, it vaults back up into the air ducts overhead and escapes. But not before being seen by Ripley and Parker, who reveal this disconcerting new information about the creature's capabilities to the rest of the crew. Realizing that it must be using the air ducts to travel through, Dallas decides to seal them off everywhere except for the main airlock, and to send someone inside the ducts with an improvised flamethrower to herd it out and eject it into space. One of the things that's unique to this movie is there's not people who have weapons to deal with this. This is not a crew of space marines. They don't have guns. They are forced to rig up their weapons from whatever they have lying around. These are incinerator units that they use to torch garbage, basically. Dallas decides to do the herding himself, even though Ripley volunteers, and asks Mother for advice on his plan. But Mother has no answers for him. Now, films like this are always an exercise in spotting the hidden protagonist, but very few movies do it as well as Alien. The screenplay establishes a number of dynamic tensions at work between each of the characters, a constant push and pull between the different personalities that's under continuous strain and that evolves with each new death. Losing Kane put the group on the defensive. Now with Brett's demise, Parker becomes more proactive about taking the fight to the alien, and Dallas becomes more determined than ever to shoulder the responsibilities of leader. It'd be just as easy to see either one of them as the final survivor as it would Ripley, and that kind of work really makes the film a lot more engaging than many of the other "and then there were none" type stories. Speaking of "and then there were none," apparently Harry Dean Stanton at the audition said he really wasn't interested in doing a science fiction movie, and Ridley Scott said neither was he. He wanted this to feel more like an Agatha Christie novel in space. I mentioned it all the way back in Friday the 13th, but really all of this kind of genre can be traced back to that first Agatha Christie novel, and then there were none. It's amazing to me what kind of influence Agatha Christie had on your favorite horror movies. With the new plan in place, Dallas goes into the vents. Lambert uses the motion tracker to give him a bead on the location of the alien. She is outside the vents, communicating this information to him inside. But it doesn't show up at first. He appears to be alone in there, but he has a gut feeling that the creature must be in there with him. Closing the hatches behind him, incidentally, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt myself, but this is one of those cases where it really makes a whole lot more sense if you assume that the alien is intelligent and able to understand English. If it's been eavesdropping on them and knows how the motion sensor works, it can then hide simply by freezing in place, because it knows how they're tracking it. This whole movie really makes a lot more sense if you assume that the alien is intelligent and knows what's going on, and that they're just drastically underestimating its capabilities. Anyway, closing the hatches behind him, he keeps going through the air ducts, firing the flamethrower as he goes, and it soon shows up on the motion detectors around the third junction. But when he gets there, he can't spot it, and it soon vanishes from Lambert's sensors as well. Realizing that the plan is rapidly becoming a disaster, Dallas decides to make for the nearest exit. But then the alien pops up on the scopes behind him, coming for him rapidly, even though he's still not seeing it. Lambert screams, begging for him to run, and this is, by the way, another one of the very iconic sequences in the film. But he gets turned around and winds up running directly into it. Both alien and Dallas's signals stop at the same time. I have to admit, even though this is an absolutely iconic sequence, I always feel like the actual surprise appearance of the alien looks a little unintentionally comical. The way it's reaching out with its palms wide gives it the appearance of sudden jazz hands, which doesn't quite convey the stark terror that the rest of the film does. At least not to me. Maybe you're terrified of jazz hands, I don't know. With Dallas dead, command falls to Ripley, who, as the movie has already established, isn't getting along with any of the other members of the surviving crew. The scene where Lambert physically assaulted Ripley for trying to enforce quarantine was cut for time, but it's still clear they don't like each other much. Parker just wants to kill the creature. Lambert is all for scuttling the ship with the self-destruct and escaping in the shuttle, and Ash is delivering excuses about collating again. But the shuttle only holds three, so Ripley decides to go with the plan they already have. Seal off the ship, leave the creature only one path to the exit, and herd it with flamethrowers into the airlock. But because she doesn't trust Ash anymore, she decides to go in and ask Mother what Mother knows about the creature. She doesn't like the answer she gets. It turns out that none of this was a coincidence. Mother was operating under Special Order 937, normally science officer's eyes only, until Ripley overrides the restriction and demands the information. Special Order 937 is, and I quote, "Nostromo rerouted to new coordinates. Investigate life form. Gather specimen. Priority 1, ensure return of organism for analysis. All other considerations secondary. Crew expendable." As always in films of this era, computers are treated basically like human beings who respond to plain English questions, albeit usually with the articles dropped off. It was a very different era, and even the best at imagining the future usually had their limits when it came to how far technology would progress. You can also hear it in the sound design. The computers sound like computers of that era, with lots of sounds of relays opening and closing instead of, you know, the technology I have on my iPhone. Just as she reads the information off the screen, Ash leans in behind her and says, "There is an explanation for all of this, you know." It's a great jump scare, even though the nitpicker in me has to point out that the door makes a big, obvious whooshing sound every other time it opens and closes, except when Ash needs to come in and startle Ripley. She responds to being startled by slamming Ash repeatedly into the wall, furious that he would side with the company over his own teammates. But as she leaves the computer room and tries to find Parker and Lambert, he traps her in the galley by overriding the doors. Incidentally, if you look closely, you'll see that she has a nosebleed. There was an entire sequence planned between her storming out of the computer room and her fight with Ash, where they tried to force the alien into the airlock and instead nearly decompressed themselves. The nosebleed is intended to be collateral damage from that attempt. With her escape cut off, Ripley goes to confront Ash and is startled to find a white liquid that looks a bit like milk trickling down his scalp. They did not use real milk. It would have spoiled rapidly and smelled awful under the stage lights. Ash grabs her, giggling, and throws her around the room with what seems to be an effortless strength before rolling up a pornographic magazine and attempting to shove it down her throat in an effort to asphyxiate her. It's an odd choice to make, albeit one that feels deeply symbolic given the sexist treatment of Ripley by every single one of her male co-workers. Even the presence of pin-up models and pornographic pictures on the walls next to the magazine seems to be kind of a bit of an unprofessional and hostile work environment, as they would use in modern terminology. But presumably his odd behavior can be explained the same way as the milky sweat. Slamming him against the wall earlier damaged something, and he's not thinking clearly at the moment. Just then, Parker and Lambert burst in, but Ash pushes them off with one hand while continuing to attack Ripley with the other. It's only when Parker hits him repeatedly on the head with a fire extinguisher that he leaves her alone, instead flailing wildly and spewing more of the milky fluid. Parker bashes him again, and this time his head flips clean back over his shoulders to hang from his neck by a flap of skin and a few wires. Because Ash, as it turns out, has some good reason to side with corporations over people. He's not a person. This was, famously, one of the decisions that led O'Bannon to repeatedly and outspokenly excoriate his co-writers Giler and Hill for adding the idea during rewrites. Did I mention they were also co-producers on the film? Again, it's always tempting to wonder what kind of career O'Bannon might have had if he'd been able to keep his temper in check. O'Bannon thought this was unnecessary, and that it added nothing but a pointless third act shock that worked only because of Holmes' performance, Scott's direction, and the hard work of the production team in bringing off the effect. Personally, I think it adds a lot. By putting in an explicit textual saboteur, it allows the plot to progress without too many dumb decisions on the character's part. Ripley gets to make the smart call to keep Kane in quarantine. Dallas gets to make the right choice to cut the facehugger off of him, and so on and so on. They were all doing the right thing, but they couldn't hope to succeed with one crew member messing up on purpose. It makes the movie less reliant on chance and misfortune and human stupidity, which always makes a film feel more believable, even though in real life, chance and misfortune and human stupidity play a pretty big part in every tragedy. Once Parker and Lambert finally disable the flailing robot by knocking its head clean off, Ripley reattaches just enough of its wires to allow it to speak in the hopes of getting some answers. But he's still bound by Special Order 937, and more importantly, he doesn't believe the creature can be killed. He calls it a perfect life form, and says that its structural perfection is matched only by its hostility. His last words before they disconnect him: "I can't lie to you about your chances, but you have my sympathies." God, Ian Holm is so good in this movie. Oddly enough, though, his death gives them the perfect opportunity to execute Lambert's plan. The shuttle holds three, and that's how many survivors are left. Ripley's going to activate the self-destruct, which appears to work by starting some kind of critical reaction in the ship's core. It looks like she removes some control rods from the main reactor. It takes 10 minutes to blow, but after 5 minutes, the reaction can no longer be stopped. While Lambert and Parker gather supplies they'll need for the trip home. Just as they're getting ready to go into action, though, Ripley realizes that Jonesy the cat is still out there, and she decides to find him and kennel him. Now, this is a decision that a lot of people have complained about, but I think they're people who don't have pets. I would totally try to get my cat out if the house was on fire. It's also something of a red herring. We're down to three potential protagonists at this point, and Parker really feels like he might be a candidate for Last Survivor. Having Ripley go and do the exact thing that got Brett killed feels very much like they're setting her up for a gruesome death, leaving him and Lambert to get to the shuttle and escape. But instead, Ripley finds the cat and puts him in a carrier, and Lambert freezes in terror as the alien drops out of the ceiling in between her and Parker. He can't use the flamethrower on it without hitting her, and she's out of places to go. She's backed up against a bulkhead, so he instead closes into melee combat with it. It kills him the same way it kills Brett, then uses its spike tail to murder Lambert. Within a matter of moments, Ripley is the lone survivor. She doesn't take much time to grieve, though. She executes the self-destruct, which is a fairly complex process involving 4 hydraulic switches, a hatch, 4 nuclear bolt heads that require special handles screwed into them to lift them out of their recesses, and quite a few keyboard commands. Although, I mean, let's face it, the last thing you want to do is make your self-destruct too easy. With the timer counting down from 10 minutes, and 5 minutes to irreversible reaction, she makes a run for the shuttle, only to find the alien blocking her path. Frantically, Ripley sprints back to try to turn off the self-destruct, but even though she forces the switches back into place only a few seconds late, Mother either can't or won't abort the countdown. With no other options, she heads back to the shuttle, determined to fight or die to get away. But the alien's gone. It's just her, Jonesy, and the last ticket out before the Nostromo and the refinery it's attached to explode. She fires up the ship and blasts off just in time to get clear before the reactors go boom. And just like that, it's all over. Ripley is safe, the creature is destroyed, and she's alone with nothing but the cat and her survivor's guilt. She places Jones into the hypersleep pod and strips down to her underwear, getting ready to freeze herself and end the movie the same way it began. But just then, one of the curved bulkheads begins to move. It reaches out a hand for her, and she realizes that the reason the alien suddenly disappeared was because, whether by instinct or intellect, it went to the last safe place it could go when the Nostromo's self-destruct timer started. This last sequence, by the way, came at the insistence of Ridley Scott, who felt like the film needed one more big scare and Ripley needed to fight the alien face to face. At one point, it was intended to end with an explicit reveal that the alien was intelligent as it killed Ripley and mimicked Dallas's voice to send out an SOS to the next crew to come along, but this was met with nothing but stony silence by studio execs, and they went with what was shown. Apparently, they told Ridley Scott, "If you film that ending, we will fire you." Nonetheless, it's important to recognize that the filmmakers did consider it entirely possible that the alien was intelligent and somehow absorbed an understanding of human language from Kane. It just didn't want to talk to anybody, it wanted to kill them. There's a lot of alien monsters out there, there's a lot of intelligent aliens that try to talk to human beings, but it's rare that you see a movie where alien intelligence does not imply a desire to communicate. It's an interesting take, and one I kind of wish would happen more often, to be honest. Getting back to the movie, Ripley backs rapidly away from the alien, which seems sluggish. Apparently it's expended a lot of energy in its rapid growth and violent exertions, and it's not on top of its game. She hides in the closet where the spacesuits are kept, climbing into one and going carefully back out while the creature yawns. Amusingly, the yawn involves extending and retracting its inner mouth. She brings a grappling hook launcher along with her, the last improvised weapon available. While singing "You Are My Lucky Star," which was apparently quite expensive to get the rights to, being part of the music catalog of Arthur Freed, which was used in Singing in the Rain, Ripley triggers a jet of coolant to spray onto the alien, driving it out of its hiding place between the bulkheads. She then has to make the terrifying choice to turn her back on it so that she can override the airlock, and there's one last moment of terror as she tries to look around and see it out of the corner of her eye and the corner of the helmet, and the mouth opens and the inner mouth begins to drool in anticipation before she slams down the button with a scream and sends it flying out into space. Only it grabs onto the doorframe. So Ripley fires the grappling hook into its chest and sends it flying out into space. Only the pistol end of the grappling hook launcher catches on the doors as they close. And finally, as it crawls over to the exhaust ports and tries to climb back into the goddamn ship again, she fires up the engines and sends it flying, for real this time, out into space. Even then, it doesn't seem harmed by the plasma blasts. Maybe Ash is right. Maybe it can't be killed. Maybe it really is the perfect organism. But at least Ripley is safe. She even has enough oxygen to take her suit off once she closes the doors again. As I mentioned before, this is one of those movies where space is thankfully forgiving. She records a final report to the company, sets course for a well-traveled region of space, and freezes herself for the 10-month journey home. And after almost 2 hours of grueling, unrelenting tension, the audience can breathe a sigh of relief. Whatever themes might be in here about corporate responsibility, bodily autonomy, and cosmic horror, and they are very clearly there, it's hard to argue that this film isn't at heart just a goddamn ordeal. And will I hang on to this movie? Well, yeah. I mean, just because it's an ordeal doesn't mean it's not an amazing, groundbreaking, beautifully shot film. Scott filmed most of it himself on handheld cameras, that's filled with some of the most intense performances in horror. This is one of the classics, a game changer, and one of the first movies to really understand the new model for the genre that Star Wars created, and I think that it's the rare fan who doesn't love it. Again, not be prescriptivist. If it's not your thing, it's not your thing, and that's okay. But the group of people who doesn't love it definitely does not include me. And if you want to talk about intelligent aliens, post-Star Wars science fiction, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter at @halfhorror, and on Tumblr and Letterboxd as Half Price Horror, where you can see any of the movies that I plan to do for the series coming up. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this film is found. And next time on Half Price Horror, we're keeping spooky season right on going with another classic of the genre, but we're leaving the 60s and 70s behind us for something a little more recent. You know how we've been mentioning in the last few episodes that it's hard to watch those old zombie, slasher, and alien monster movies without wondering why nobody notices that they're in a zombie, slasher, or alien movie and does the thing that the audience is screaming at them to do? Well, in the 90s, someone thought about that. And it wasn't just the audience screaming. Yep, we're looking at 1996's seminal meta-slasher, Scream. See you then.